this time, since we're about to move on to a long evening session, it is useful to get a little food. Representative Brian is here. Why don't you come on up? We have House Bill 2202. I guess that's it, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Also here on 3438.
And 3438. So we'll take, let's take 2202 first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Bryan, State Representative, District 9. 2202 has a fairly lengthy history to it, except I won't get into any of that unless to respond to your questions. Basically, the Corrections Division brought us this bill early in the session at the recommendation of the Secretary of State's Audit Section, and it codifies a practice which has been occurring for a number of years, wherein funds from vending machines and canteen and phone revenues go to the recreation program. After discussion, this went to Ways and Means, where the funds were examined, and there were some excess funds. The fund runs in a very healthy way, and we identified initially $500,000 and now about $1 million of the $2.6 million that doesn't really need to be used for recreation, and still leaving a very healthy recreation program. I had recommended that we add the amendment that the funds also be used on inmate education programs, including drug and alcohol. And the Ways and Means added that amendment, and that's what you see before you after a unanimous House vote. So I would just encourage positive action on the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, some of us are aware of your extensive involvement in trying to get a fix on what is or isn't happening and what might be appropriate. So thank you for your work on it.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Purse, why don't you just stay there and then...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Purse, Director of Corrections, and obviously this was our bill before the House. We did do a number of things at the request of Representative Bryan. We began looking even closer at our inmate accounts. As you're aware, that was one of the investigations that I asked the Secretary of State to take on in 1989, and as a result of their investigation, they indicated we needed to get legislative approval for collecting the funds and spending them, which we did in House Bill 2202. As Representative Bryan says, when we began working with we did revise how we would pay for the inmate education funds, and also to deal with some shortfalls in drug and alcohol treatment for inmates. And as a result of that, we now have the bill has been attached as a part of the Ways and Means Senate Bill 5541, the department's budget. And it is all now part of another fund budget as opposed to just the department spending it without any specific budget authority. And we request the committee's approval of the bill.
Thank you. Other questions for Fred? Jeanette.
Quickie, if I may, Madam Chair. Fred, could you tell me, I'm just looking at page 3 or 4 of your document on your alcohol and drug treatment for inmates. What kind of treatment process do you use? I'll be more direct. Does corrections use methadone?
No, Senator, okay. Madam Chair, Senator Hamby, we do not.
Right.
Not in the institutions. I'm not sure that I assume there may be some who are out in the field who, yes, under court direction. But we do not use it in the institutions.
Thank you. How are the programs going that we've had some discussion with out in the field since last session and just kind of being implemented with some of those institutions? I know we had a debate with Vera about acupuncture and what configuration that was really going to end up being out I forget which institution it was. But
Madam Chair, the we now have 280 beds that we do keep. We have inmates in that in the institutions in three different types of intensive alcohol and drug treatment, including the 100-bed facility at Columbia River in Portland. We were doing some acupuncture. I asked them to try that when we opened that, and they've been trying it. We've just now stopped doing it and are including it in the aftercare. It doesn't seem to have the effect when people are institutionalized as it does when they're trying to stay off of it and they're not institutionalized. And so we've directed the contractor who provides that service at the Columbia River to, in fact, include it in their aftercare, but we've ceased doing it at the institution.
Right.
And as far as the, I think it's too early to be able to tell what all the other programs, other than Cornerstone, which has a long history, you know, is a very effective program. The one in Baker is only a year old, and we haven't had enough follow-up on that to be able to tell you anything significant at this time. And of course, Columbia River just started, so we'll be following those inmates with aftercare treatment for some time after they leave the programs, and then we'll be able to ascertain which of the programs has the most effective benefit to reduce recidivism.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Thank you. I guess I would ask, are there, I'm willing to accept a motion on this. Okay. Senator Hanman moves House Bill 2202 unamended to the floor with the Dewcrest recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill? Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Now let's move to House Bill 3438. Representative Ryan is here with people have worked in the last few days with the amendments, and I think we have good agreement, and appreciate your shepherding this through, Representative Ryan. Yeah.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Bryan, State Representative, District 9, Tiger. Being distributed, I believe, are the -6 amendments, which incorporate all of the amendments to date. There were a number of amendments floating around at the last meeting, and -3 amendments and -5 amendments were combined along with the other agreements of the parties, and I believe we now have a consensus among the private care providers, the counties, CSD, and the representatives of the collective bargaining units in the language represented in -6. And issues primarily were having a juvenile parole officer and a caseworker appointed to the Juvenile Justice Council. That's included. that the existing collective bargaining unit be honored, and that's included. And that an independent evaluation be conducted by CSD, and that the CSD and the Juvenile Corrections Council shall agree jointly to the development of the evaluation.
Okay, are there, that's basically what, how did they finally resolve the sort of agreements with collective bargaining? It says nothing is act supersedes.
Right.
I'm just looking at the amendments to see if you could just.
Right. Page 2, lines 7 through 9 are the only references, well, pardon me, 10 and 11, lines 10 and 11, page 2, the only references there. There have been informal discussions about the intent of the parties with regard to where the pilot programs are selected, that the collective bargaining units will work with the management representatives to work towards the intent of the bill, and that has reached satisfactory level.
So you just basically left it open in that sense.
That's correct.
Without defining it specifically. Thank you, Paul.
Great. Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and with me is Mary Bodkin, representing Oregon AFSCME. With respect to the collective bargaining issue, it takes out from the original Dash 5 amendments a phrase that previously said... Where is it? Oh, covering the terms and conditions of employment of current employees, so that what would be left would be to say that nothing in this act affects existing collective bargaining agreements. The reason for that change is to say this, that if the creation of a pilot program violates or affects a collective bargaining agreement that's currently in place, then the parties will bargain over the terms of the collective bargaining agreement only. And secondly, that they will do that in good faith to accomplish the goals of the Act, the primary goal of which is to integrate the case management system. And I believe AFSCME and AOC are in agreement as to that meaning and that direction.
Great. Thank you. Do you have anybody else who wants to come up? Mary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin, representing Oregon Council 75 AFSCME. Janine Meyer Rodriguez from OPEU and I and Tom Bryan and a variety of folks have worked very hard to kind of put the right words on paper to accomplish the goals set forth both in this bill as well as to protect the rights of the collective bargaining agents to bargain over the changes that will occur in those areas where we have pilot programs that are going to operate. We think the changes that we've made in the amendments, the changes that we've made in the bill will allow everybody to move forward with a little more security about where we're going and how we're going to get there, and to bring the workers along with the union management as well as the county and state management to where everybody's comfortable doing the job and doing a good job of it. So we're comfortable. The only thing I need to say is when I wrote up the note to you, Senator, this morning after we had met, I made an error just in the first set of amendments where we put in appointed by the collective bargaining agent for the board makeup. That needs to be corrected both in Section 6 and 21, and that's just a logistical correction about who actually appoints those people. And it's my understanding that all of the folks who are members of that board are selected by the organization that they represent.
But it is in the Dash 6.
Is it? Okay. Well, we got him to Ingrid, but we got him there late, so she thought she could catch it, but she wasn't sure. All right. Dash 6. I have them now. Thank you, Senator.
And so they are. It is in the Dash 6. Ingrid tells us.
Madam Chair, that's correct on page 2, line 27.
That's great. That's great.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Brian.
Let me check the original bill because that word may have to be recommended by if it's, I think the other.
I'm not sure they can appoint. I think you're right. I think you're correct.
Okay.
It's very, let's see what the original bill says.
It actually is silent from what I can see about who does the appointments.
Right, Madam Chair,
yes,
Section 20 of the bill says the assistant director for the CSD shall establish a juvenile corrections council. The council shall consist of, and then there's a list, and in each case it says a representative of the Juvenile Judges Association, two representatives of. So the language would be to, I think, Madam Chair, to add that there would be a representative of the juvenile parole.
Well, I guess I still think that we need the word recommended there because it should be actually formally recommended by the bargaining agent rather than someone than the assistant director of CSD picking an individual. I think that probably they'd have more faith if it comes from some recommendation from the
and I understand
official.
The recommended is versus the appointed. That's no problem for us.
Okay. I'd agree with that.
Let's change the word then on the dash six amendments on line 28 to recommended.
And Madam Chair, it also appears on page 1, line 11.
Okay. And 13.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, on page 2, line 29 and 30.
Right. Anything else? Anything else on this bill?
Good bill. Well, mediocre bill should pass. No.
Great bill should pass. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your
Thank you. Thank
patience.
You all for your hard work you over the last few months on this. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your patience, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have the A6 amendments as they've been amended, corrected here. Are there objections to the A6 amendments?
I'll move them, Madam Chair.
Senator Hill moves them. Hearing no objections, they are so ordered. Okay. I think the bill is ready, folks.
Madam Chair, then I would move House Bill 3438 as amended. Do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Hill moves House Bill 3438 to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman? Senator Benn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cullen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. All right, we have Fred here. Let's move to House Bill 2199. This is a bill that's probably been had more fussing around since it was one of the first House bills that arrived in our committee, and everybody was in a great clamor to say it had to move immediately. And it, but we are here, I think, with amendments, and we appreciate your...
Madam Chair, Fred, First Director Corrections. Yes, it seemed like a really simple bill when we submitted it, and it went through the House, and it obviously got a lot of work done. But we're very we're pleased with the amendments that were provided for us today, and it's my understanding that... everybody's bought off on these amendments now. You may want to find out from somebody else. But
yeah, I think if the committee will remember, this bill had to do with the testing by the corrections employees. We had testimony from the people who ran laboratories, and we had testimony from the health division. We had testimony from the various run of pharmaceuticals who provided kits or non-kits or equipment versus kits, and so we had a lot of entrepreneurial and trade
scientific
proprietary
proprietary is the word I'm reaching for proprietary interests involved in this as well, so we've tried. I think Ingrid might want to go through them to walk the fine line, not to make proprietary judgments here, proprietary judgments, nor proprietary judgments either one. So that's where we are. Okay. Springer.
Well, I think our first witness on this was Dr. Belsey, who pathologist. Have we heard from him since, or do we know if his concerns would be addressed by these amendments?
I believe they are. We have not had direct communication with him, but through the health division have addressed the concerns that he raised, I believe.
Okay. respective clinician and constituent, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, Ingrid, do you want to go through what we've done?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please, briefly.
The original bill basically would have exempted field test kits from the testing requirements and the lab requirements. The amendments take a different approach. They substitute for the contents of the bill an amendment to ORS 438-435, which deals with clinical laboratories. And current law provides a special procedure for what are called special category laboratories, but the Corrections Division did not meet the criteria set forth for those laboratories. These amendments would add special category screening, and screening could be done by correctional officers with respect to inmates and clients on probation or parole. And that the screening process would be approved by the Health Division, and the specific technologies would also be approved by the Health Division. The screening process could be used basically to affect the status of inmates in correctional facilities. They could be held in secure custody after a positive result on one of these preliminary screenings. Thereafter, a confirmatory test would be required in all cases, and the only people whose liberty or benefits would be affected prior to that confirmatory test would be inmates in institutions. And they would simply be allowed under this bill to be detained in secure custody pending the confirmatory test. But the preliminary test would also have to meet Health Division standards. That appears to meet constitutional concerns. The Corrections Division probably has, and maybe Mr. Peirce could testify to this, probably already has the authority to detain those inmates based on reasonable suspicion of some kind that they are using drugs.
Yes, Madam Chair. Our main problem, quite frankly, in the institutions is in the minimums where we do the random testing or we do suspicion testing. And the inmates, quite often, if they know they're dirty, they're gonna take a hike and leave us if they're in a minimum before we have a chance to get the report back from the lab. So that's why the field test kits, just to indicate to us in advance that there's more than just suspicion, that in fact there's a showing. We then send them to an institution in which they can be held where it isn't so easy to walk away, pending the resolution by the lab test. And then the lab test comes back. If it confirms it, then we hold a hearing and actions taken. If it does not, then they're returned to the minimum. So that's the reason we put this bill in. And it also provides an easier way for the parole and probation officer to ascertain a client or an offender, whether or not that is required to do a test, whether or not they are, in fact, dirty as well. We would request that consideration be given to put an emergency clause on this. It is really critical that we get this moving so that we can get approval and begin doing it officially.
Hey, Senator Hamby.
Fred, how long, what time span is it that one is held?
Generally, the tests are back within 5 to 7 days.
7 days.
But they're already in institutions. Mm-hmm. It's only those who are in the minimums who don't have that, where we don't have security, mm-hmm. that we can hold them.
Is there a chance, without further amending this dash one, that you could report back next session and alert us to the accuracy of your screening?
We'd be happy to, you bet, and we'll keep accurate records on that so that we do that anyway to make sure that what we're using is the best we can use. Yes, be happy to, Senator Hammond.
I do think that's a good note and a good comment. I think that will make it, before we move further down the line of this as a process, it is important, I think, to get some feedback to find out what the actual sort of results look like and what's happening in the field under somewhat more controlled circumstance and sort of opening that wide up.
We'll set up an evaluation system to do that.
Great, thank you. Senator Springer?
If, as Fred has suggested, there's some urgency, I don't know if an emergency clause would help,
yes.
And or do we have any assurance from the Health Division as to how quickly they can adopt rules? Are they ready to do this to meet Fred's needs?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, it's certainly my understanding that as a result of these amendments, we've all agreed to, that they are prepared to go forward and promulgate the rules right away. I'd certainly would hope that would be the sense of the committee as well in passing the legislation, because it is a critical issue for us.
I do think we need to add emergency clause. And are there objections to amending the dash one as Senator Springer suggested, the emergency clause? Hearing none, that's ordered. Thank you. Okay, Senator Happey, we need the amendment. Senator Happey moves the dash one amendments. Okay, Mr. Bernanke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention, for the record, Dave Fedanke, ACLU of Oregon. There was a slight change in the language that Legislative Council came up with in the dash one from the initial draft of the amendment that I had seen. And it shows up in subsection 6, lines 19 and 20. The original draft said if a special category screening test of an inmate of a state or local correctional facility is positive. And I think it may add some clarity to insert inmate of a state or local correctional facility. I guess what I would suggest is inserting on line 20, if a screening test of an inmate of a state or local correctional facility is positive for a substance of abuse, the inmate may be held. But just to make that absolutely clear,
well,
who it applies to.
I'm not sure we're going to.
I had the same problem as I was reading this. Inmate is not otherwise defined. Nowhere else does it appear.
It's referred to up above, but the first part of subsection 6 deals with everyone who is subjected to screening tests, including employees, prospective employees. It's a generally applicable section. And then starting at the end of line 19, it goes back to dealing with inmates. And I think I just might add some clarity to insert that phrase. I want to be sure that somebody who was on probation or parole doesn't become an inmate between the time the screening test is done and when it might be submitted for confirmation.
Madam Chair, we would have no objection to inserting that in there.
Okay. I'm going to look to Ingrid here for a moment to see what was in there originally.
Madam Chair, I think, what I provided to Legislative Council were copies, two copies of the proposed amendments presented by two of the interested groups, which were basically identical, and I asked Legislative Council to include them both and use whichever language seemed more appropriate. But I believe it was everyone's intention that it be limited to state and local correctional facility inmates. So adding that would.
So where would you lead us through that exactly then, Ingrid, please?
Madam Chair, I believe it would be on page 2 of the dash 1 amendments, line 19, after the word inmate.
No.
I don't 20. See any inmate in line 19.
20. The 20, I beg your pardon.
Okay.
After the word inmate of a state or local correctional facility.
David?
Madam Chair, what I was suggesting was to insert inmate of a state or local correctional facility at the beginning of line 20 prior to the word is, rather than sticking it in later in the sentence. To make clear that they're an inmate at the time the screening test is taken. I think that's the intent, and I just want to be sure that nobody misunderstands the language once it's in statute.
Okay, well, I'm not clear what the language would be if you're doing that way.
I think it would then read, if a screening test of an inmate of a state or local correctional facility is positive for a substance of abuse, the inmate may be held.
Exactly.
Okay, Senator Hill moves that amendment.
Yes.
Thank you.
Are there objections to that amendment? Thank you. And so ordered. Okay, Senator Hamby moves dash one first. Are there Senator Hamby moves the dash one as we've amended it to the bill. Are there objections? Yes. Hurry here. Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2199 as we've amended it to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Discussion. Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman. Senator Benn.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, let's move.
Madam Chair, since I wasn't here at the last hearing on this, I don't know if this point, Dave Fidanke, ACLU of Oregon, if this point was made by Stevie Remington on our behalf, but we are concerned that municipal courts are not courts of record, and any action in a municipal court presumably would be appealable to district court, but that would just be another level of bureaucracy here. We would just assume these things started in district court if they were going to happen at all.
Justice court?
I don't think justice courts can deal with these, but if they can, we certainly don't want them there.
Yeah.
All.
I think Mr. Bellamy shakes his head yes that they can.
Well, Madam Chair, clarification. All we're doing is saying that upon a current conviction for these violations, wherever that conviction applies, the vehicle is gone.
Yeah, I think that all they're saying is you don't have a record on which to appeal it in some of those areas.
Well, but once you appeal it to the district court, so you start the process over again, your vehicle still isn't gone. You still have the same rights you've always had. And if we remove the municipal and district, excuse me, the municipal and justice courts, there is a $4 million fiscal impact on the state court system to deal with the additional load that would be created by shifting from the existing action that goes on.
But wouldn't that load still be there if they're going to appeal those convictions in order to get the car back?
If you assume most of the cases aren't appealed, if you assume that they will be appealed because of this change, then that could happen.
Okay.
Grab that vote.
Don't go too far, bud.
Grab that vote.
Madam Chair, while we're pondering, I'd also like to hear a little bit more about the proceeds of all of this going to the sheriff's office. Somehow that doesn't.
The well, in dealing with the city of Portland, they are basically losing money on the proposition. It is not a profitable operation. Whether they make a little, lose a little, we don't know. But the idea is to deal with the vehicle, not generate a whole bunch of money, and it probably will not generate a bunch. One of the problems with the way it's handled in Portland, about half, and I don't know the exact number, but about half of the vehicles are financed. So those are taken out of the process. Of the remaining, they've got a lot of vehicles that are junkers. They end up subsidizing disposing of those through selling other vehicles. This would have a slightly better potential for more than breaking even. But again, the idea is not to generate money for the sheriff's office. The idea is simply to get those vehicles out of
the situation that they're being used in. And the original bill had it going through the arresting agency. The state police were very concerned about the process of how you deal with and dispose of that. They are not set up to dispose of vehicles. Neither is the city, but the sheriff's office is the one police agency that is familiar with and has a process set up for disposing of property. And so it was logical that they would dispose of it, and since they would have to go through the entire process to allow them to recoup that cost, they would get the proceeds.
I think that we'll wait for the chair for the A12 amendments. Why don't you go ahead and if you wanted to explain the others.
Okay. The A13 amendment is the one that sets the 10-year window so that a conviction would cause the law to come into effect if there had been another conviction or diversion within a 10-year period. So that unlike the original bill, which had no relief for someone who had been convicted 30 years earlier or 20 years earlier, now we would say if it's within 10 years, then it comes into play. And I think right now when police check the records, that's actually what they're generally checking anyway, is a 10-year period.
I think so.
That actually didn't matter to me one way or the other, but it did seem a reasonable request. If someone's been able to stay out of trouble for 10 years, they've probably not had a major problem. That may not be a fair statement, but. And then the A14, again, is the set of amendments dealing with the appeal process to make sure that someone does not lose the vehicle and then have the conviction reversed after the vehicle has been disposed of.
Are there any questions about A11, A13, A14 amendments? Any discussion? Yes.
I apologize.
Yes, Senator Hamby.
Did we resolve the municipal?
Not yet.
We've not. I just wanted to know.
Yeah, that's the A11 amendment. I'm going to vote against the A11 amendments. I think if we're going to do this, it better have the dignity of a full-blown conviction in an appropriate court.
We save an explanation of the A12 amendments for your. So you.
Good. Yes, A12. As you said, Gary. Well, this is the markings. Okay.
The A12 amendment.
I have 12 and 13.
Madam Chair, the A12 were those proposed by DMV, and they can present it in more detail if needed. Okay. But also, I need to note on line 13, the number 35 on page 1, line 13 of the A12, the number 35 should have and number 33. But that would allow, rather than requiring the sticker to be placed on the plate, it could be placed on a window, and the DMV could, by rule, set that.
So you move that change then?
So I would move the adoption of the A12 amendments with the change on line 13.
Yeah, are there objections? Again, so ordered. Okay.
I would move the A13 amendment, which is the 10-year window.
Are there objections to that, to the 13s? Hearing none, so ordered.
I would move the A14, which is the stay pending appeal.
Are there objections to the 14-14s? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay,
and so finally, I'll move the A11, which is the amendment that leaves the status quo on who handles violations of 813.010.
Okay, so that's a problem for Senator Shoemaker.
No on that.
Yeah, and I think that's basically a problem too. Let's call the roll on the dash 11 amendments.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one question?
Yes.
Wouldn't it be neater to get a little broader support for the bill by just moving partially rather than including the justice?
No. Senator Hamby, the original bill applied to all.
Everyone.
The amendments took the authority away from the Municipal and Justice Court.
Oh, I see.
And all this is doing is saying we didn't need to take that away because local agencies do not receive the benefit, and therefore they have no advantage in citing into their own court in order to take a vehicle. And what I'm trying to avoid is any more significant change than necessary, and also avoid a $4 million fiscal impact to the state that, for all practical purposes, destroys this bill if we do not adopt the dash A11 amendment.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Since you put it that way, aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
No.
Senator Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
No. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd move the bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Bunn moves House Bill of Senate Bill 859 as it's amended to the floor with a do-pass.
Madam Chair, just
yes.
Briefly, one reminder, we're dealing with about 13,000 cases per biennium where someone is stopped on not the first, but second and subsequent driving under the influence. And nothing that we're doing is effectively curbing that. And I think this might do for drunk driving somewhat of what Portland's ordinance has done for prostitution in Portland.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Senator
Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
No. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Drunk driving, huh?
Are we done?
No.
Wow.
I saw people.
No, we're
come on.
We're waiting for Max on the pet. Let's move into House Bill 2681, folks. This is the pornography bill. Or excuse me, the yes, the child. 2681. Oh. Ingrid, I guess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when this bill was here for public hearing, the proponents indicated that they approved of the what has just been handed out, the dash A4 amendments, and that would move the library exception to another location so that it would apply only to certain of the offenses covered by the measure. The committee heard from the proponents and also from the ACLU. The ACLU proposed amendments which would have restricted application of the provisions to those circumstances where the material had been brought into the state in violation of law. The proponents were not in favor of those amendments. Issues raised by committee members with respect to the contents of the bill included on page 2 of the bill line 16, the use of the language "or graphic focus on." And secondly, in section 8, line 40 of page 2, the deletion of the requirement that a person pay or give something of value in order to view either an explicit conduct of a child or a depiction of such conduct in order for it to be included among the offenses. Deleting the requirement for pay would basically mean that anyone who viewed pornography involving depictions of children or those actual acts would come under the provisions of the measure, regardless of whether they paid for it or regardless of whether they personally possessed any such material.
Okay, so the Senator Sprayer wanted to move the graphic focus on out of there.
Well,
do you want to do that?
I think my, well, I prefer to move the ACLU amendments if you want to deal with that issue, but I think one of my questions was it still wasn't very clear to me just what that meant, and when you define a criminal law, I think you run into serious problems unless you can have a definition that is readily understandable, and that,
which is it, you know?
I don't think was clear to me.
Excuse me, Senator Shoemaker,
what was the ACLU amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it just says proposed Oregon ACLU amendments.
Well, what do they do?
They would limit application of the bill to circumstances where the material had been brought into the state in violation of law, basically, where it had been produced in violation of an Oregon law or brought into the state in violation of a provision which made it illegal to produce it in the jurisdiction where it was produced.
Are they going to be speaking to that?
No. Well, I mean, you can ask them.
Did we discuss that last time?
This, you probably weren't. I don't know if you were here. We've discussed it with the
I don't seem to have it, so I guess probably I had left at that time. Oh, no, here they are. I'm sorry. I do have them, but I don't think I've heard a discussion.
Okay. Thank you. You want to come up and explain the amendments? But I think it basically does limit the bill to the point where that's it. But that's okay. I mean, I don't have a problem. You may disagree with that. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can really illuminate the committee any more than it has been already in terms of what the intent is of the amendments. I think it's hopefully that my understanding from having talked to Stevie, who talked to the attorney who drafted these, is that the intent would just be to ensure that this bill didn't sweep any farther than materials that had been produced illegally, either here in the state of Oregon or in another state, and then brought into Oregon in violation of federal law.
And what is the reach of that, the illegal production of these materials in this state? I'll assume other states are similar.
That's currently in the statutes. I don't have it in front of me. I'm not sure it's the statute.
Oh, Ingrid might have some comments on it.
Madam Chair, ORS 163677 prohibits the transporting of child pornography into the state, and it basically says that that crime is committed if the person brings into the state or causes to be brought in materials depicting children under 18 engaged in explicit sexual conduct.
Okay. And what about the laws of the state? Produced in violation of the laws of this state, which I assume is 683. Well, no. I don't know what it would be. We have laws against production?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the current statute is 163665 through 163690. most of those statutes are included in the Angros bill, but I'm not sure all of them are.
This is a part of the bill they're amending.
So you would see the... For the most part, you would see the existing statute in, as you walk through the bill.
665 is the top of page 2.
Yeah.
And they are amending it.
And the bulk of these provisions were adopted in 1987.
Well, if it's illegal to produce in this state anything which would violate this act if you possess it, then what is the... I guess one question is, what is the necessity of including that amendment, and what is... what would be the necessity of including the amendment? Contrary, what would be the harm of including the amendment?
I think the importance of including it is to just further clarify that the what is covered under the statute is what is impermissible to produce in this state, or that which might be brought in from out of state in violation of the federal law, which may be somewhat broader than what is included in under current Oregon law. I'm not sure.
In order to convict somebody of possessing, would you have to also first prove that it was produced in violation or brought into the state in violation? I mean, would you have to know the facts on that? What if you just didn't know? All you know was know is that it... that if it was, it's illegal. Would it add that additional
That's
element to the proof?
I think it would.
So
add
it would
that
have an additional element of proof that might be very hard to establish because you wouldn't have any idea where that stuff came from.
Yeah, but it is a rebuttable presumption, Madam Chair, that it was produced in violation.
So it would be up to the defendant to prove it hadn't been.
Oh. Well, that makes a difference.
Yeah. Madam Chair, there was one other item which was not in the printed amendments that were submitted at the previous hearing that was suggested in our testimony, and that would be to add the language on page 1 of the Angros bill at the end of line 10, for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desire of the person. So that line would read, videotape or other visual recording of sexually explicit conduct involving a child for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desire of the person. And that tracks very closely language in the public indecency statute.
Dave, isn't there a big difference on trying to prove arousal during public indecency and trying to prove arousal when somebody has something in a, stored away in a closet, and trying to go back and prove that at some time there was arousal associated with that possession?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I think what we're trying to get at here is... it's my understanding that as the bill is currently written, it would prohibit anyone from possessing this material, even if their purpose were to convince people to strengthen the laws prohibiting possession of similar material or enhance the penalties. Our purpose in offering that language is to make it clear that the statute should only reach persons for whom
who possessed it for the reason of arousing sexual gratification. I think it...
Wouldn't that be very, very difficult for the DA to prove?
I think that would depend on the context of the situation. Again, the committee might be more comfortable having that be a rebuttable presumption type of situation, where if the person could prove that that was not their reason for possessing it. Mm-hmm. We think it would lessen the constitutional problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Eliminate.
Let's take a break here for a moment and go back to the pets. We have the Mannix here. So I should stop people's train of thought.
This
process, where it is.
Where
it is this time
Balls
of year.
Balls in the air.
Yes.
Guess I was asking questions. So.
Yes. We have back to 2250.
2660.
Pardon me.
I'll identify myself for the record. Representative Kevin Mannix, District 32.
Kevin, I think I'm the cause of interrupting your
afternoon. Well, not entirely. We've got Senator Bunn who has problems with questions about Section 3 as well.
Okay.
Or maybe the old bill, but that's okay. Senator Schumacher.
I was questioning a couple things, but first was whether we know what a retail pet store is, as used on line 18 as an exemption from animal dealer.
The retail pet stores who asked for that exemption were satisfied with it, and I would just use a common sense definition of a store where they're selling pets at retail and just leave it at that. That was meant to say that if you've got a place you're selling pets at retail, retail is itself a term of art where you're open to the public and individual items can be purchased from you being open
sort
to
like
the public
card
in fashion. And the retail pet store operators felt that it's a pretty generic definition for their kind of operation. But there's a big difference between that and what we're trying to get at, which is really a wholesale kind of operation.
Right. I know what you're trying to get at, and I'm, of course, concerned about this reaching things which you're not trying to get at. And one of my concerns was that if the family pet has a litter of puppies and the child of the family decides to, with the family's blessing, to sell the puppies. Now, he doesn't own the puppies. He goes out and tries to create a market for his puppies. Aside from the fact that he's presumably under 18, would that, surely you don't intend that that would...
No, and I think they'd be covered by a dual exemption here. One is any person who sells a person's companion animal or the offspring of the companion animal, one is not an animal dealer. Secondly, if someone's acting as the agent of that person, you wonder, well, is they would be exempt as the agent of that person, but you get back to animal dealer, is this person acquiring or maintaining possession with the intention of selling the animal to another person? And
yes.
The key there, I think, is acquiring or maintaining. Maintaining possession would be temporarily receiving possession of an animal is not maintaining possession. We're getting at people who are keeping dogs or cats in kennels for a long period of time. I'm running through the rest of this this provision because this question just came up. I think the simple answer would be that the person is acting as an agent for the person's who's selling their own companion animal or offspring of their companion animal.
Even if the child is keeping the proceeds, I think he'd still be acting as an agent.
I think so.
Okay, well, I think that's probably, maybe we have enough legislative record on that. The next point was over on line 25 of page 2, where it's the crime of unlawfully obtaining. And I was wondering whether, it doesn't refer to companion animal there, it's any person other than an animal dealer, no, who is an animal dealer, as you've defined it.
who obtains any dog or cat from a person who is from other than the person who raised the animal. And I was wondering if that ought not read obtains a companion animal or offspring of a companion animal to cover the puppy situation.
We used dog or cat in reaction to requests from a variety of interests, including animal research facilities, to limit the bill to dogs or cats generally. But companion animal, as you note, is defined in here also. And I'm just trying to think if it's possible to use that phrase, which would be more cautious.
Companion animal is limited to a dog or a cat.
Right. And it's possessed, da-da-da-da-da-da.
So if we said obtains a companion animal or the offspring of a companion animal, the person who has not raised such companion animal.
If I can pause for a moment, I think that we could restrict it that without doing any damage. I'd like to take a look at.
I think
we'd be all right to do that.
That makes me more comfortable. Thanks.
In fact, we originally had done that, but someone decided that all the companion animal references should be changed back to dog or cat, and I think what happened is that got changed back to dog or cat, and
would you like to move that, Senator Schumann?
Yeah, I will move that. The reference to dog or cat, where it appears on line 25 of page 2, and it appears twice, read companion animal or offspring of a companion animal.
Did you get that, Ingrid?
Yes, thank you.
Is there any objection?
I don't think we need to do line 23. I defer to.
Well, one at a time.
I would agree with you on this.
Yes. Is there any objection to Senator Schumacher's motion? Not. So ordered. Senator Bunn, did you have some questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First, under the bill, would it be illegal for an animal dealer to obtain a dog or a cat from a retail sales?
Yes, and that was brought up specifically with the retail people. The retail people said they don't